Jim O'Flaherty. Thanks for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. This is another special edition, as I'm not doing an interview, which is the usual format of the show. Instead, I'm sharing portions of the three additional talks that were at the Inklings Fellowship Weekend at Montreat College from earlier this month, April 2016, where I also spoke. What follows are 15 minutes each of talks given by Don King, Dennis Beats, and Hal Poe. The theme of the weekend was The Devil and C.S. Lewis. Previously, I shared my entire talk that was about the Screwtape Letters, and you can check the show notes for a direct link to that. With just a musical transition between each, what follows is Don King dealing with a preface to Paradise Lost, then highlights from Dennis Beats on Perlandra, that is next, and then finally I share a portion of Hal Poe's talk about The Great Divorce. Be sure to catch the next Inklings Fellowship Weekend. There is a general link to their website where details will be found when it is available. Plus, if there is still time, consider joining the Inklings Fellowship Week, which will be in Oxford, that is in late July 2016. Links are in the show notes for details about it and to an interview I did with Hal Poe about it.
Devil to Devil, John Milton, C.S. Lewis, A Preface to Paradise Lost, and Screwtape. Before C.S. Lewis was 10 years old, he wrote in his diary, now think about that, this is when he's 9 years old, "I read Paradise Lost, Reflections thereon." While it's unclear how much of John Milton's masterpiece he actually read and understood at this young age, this entry marks Lewis's early affection and admiration for Milton's verse. Furthermore, this entry foreshadows the pervasive influence of Milton's poetry in particular, in Lewis's literary maturation. For instance, Lewis writes his great friend Arthur Greaves about his love for Milton, claiming that, and now he's referring to another one of Milton's work, a mask called Comus. Lewis writes Greaves, "Comus is an absolute dream of delight, and it's agreed to be one of the most perfect things in English poetry." His praise of Paradise Lost to Greaves is more frequent and sustained. He tells Greaves at one point after rereading the first two books of Paradise Lost that, "I really love Milton every time I come back to him." A month later, he adds in a letter, "I have finished Paradise Lost again." And by the way, this is when Lewis is about 18 years old. "I finished Paradise Lost again, enjoying it even more this time. In Milton is everything you get everywhere else, only better. He is as voluptuous as Keats, as romantic as Morris, as grand as Wagner, as weird as Poe, and a better lover of nature than even the Brontes." Dozens of letters that Lewis writes to other correspondents contains lines that he quotes out of Paradise Lost as he makes a point or is discussing something. In short, it's no exaggeration to say that the greatest influence on Lewis's early poetic maturation and development was Milton. Further, while Lewis came to fall under the sway of other great writers, I believe Milton is the greatest single literary influence on the work of Lewis. Accordingly, it's no surprise to find that Lewis's The Screwtape Letters owe a great debt to Milton, especially Paradise Lost. In what follows here this morning, I'll briefly note Milton's influence on selected early works of Lewis, explore what Lewis has to say about Satan in his preface to Paradise Lost, and conclude by noting a number of specific Miltonic influences on Screwtape Letters. The first indication of Milton's pervasive influence appears in Lewis's first published volume, a volume of early poems entitled Spirits in Bondage. This is in 1919, so Lewis is roughly 20 years old. Lewis's initial title for the book was not Spirits in Bondage, but instead it was Spirits in Prison. But his father pointed out to him that there had already been a book published with that title. That's a problem. So, here's what Lewis did. He took a passage from book one of Paradise Lost, and from that passage he draws the title, Spirits in Bondage. Here's the brief passage. For this infernal pit shall never hold celestial spirits in bondage, nor the abyss long under darkness cover. That comes from one of Satan's early speeches in Paradise Lost. Another indication of Milton's influence upon Lewis from that same volume, Spirits in Bondage, is the poem entitled Milton Read Again in Surrey. The poem is written as a panegyric in the style of John Keats's On First Looking into Chapman's Homer, or William Wordsworth's London 1802, by the way, another poem praising Milton. Milton Read Again is Lewis's tribute to Milton. Though it's impossible to date the poem precisely, it was probably written sometime between 1914 and 1917, while Lewis was studying with his great teacher, W.T. Kirkpatrick, in Surrey, south of London. In the poem, Lewis is celebrating his recent rereading of Paradise Lost. He writes in the poem, "Three golden months, while summer on us sold, I have read your joyful tale another time, breathing more freely in that larger clime, and learning wiselier to deserve the whole." He calls Milton his master in the poem and thanks him for guiding him and showing him his treasures rare. Before he read Milton, Lewis says he was unable to see the natural beauties of the Surrey countryside. Now, however, he compares his reading of Milton to one who returns to a familiar walk in a wood, suddenly overcome with the, as he says in the poem, the weird spirit of unexplained delight. New mystery in every shady place, in every whispering tree and nameless grace, new rapture on the windy seaward height. Here Lewis credits Milton with guiding him to the treasures of poetry, opening his eyes to a rich imagination where before his had been at least somewhat barren. Now I'm going to skip ahead about 20 years, and we learn that when Lewis writes his brother, Warren, a letter in July of 1940 about his initial conception of the Screwtape Letters, he refers to Milton. Here's what Lewis says in the letter. He begins by saying that he and a friend had recently heard Hitler speaking on the radio. Again, this is 1940. Lewis writes, "I don't know if I'm weaker than other people, but it's a positive revelation to me that while the speech lasts, it's impossible not to waver just a little. I should be useless as a schoolmaster or a policeman. Statements which I know to be untrue all but convince me, at any rate for the moment, if only the man says them unflinchingly. The same weakness is why I am a slow examiner. If a candidate with a bold, mature handwriting attributed Paradise Lost to Wordsworth, I should feel a tendency to go and look it up for fear he might be right after all." When the letter continues, Lewis explains the genesis of the Screwtape Letters. In addition, he offers an example of how one might fall under the sway of a powerful speaker. So here's the excerpt from the letter to his brother. "I've been to church for the first time for many weeks owing to illness. Before the service was over today, one could wish these things came more seasonably, I was struck by an idea for a book which I think might be both useful and entertaining. It would be called as One Devil to Another, and would consist of letters from an elderly retired devil to a young devil who has just started work on his first patient. The idea would be to give all the psychology of temptation from the other point of view." And by the way, in another part of this letter, basically Lewis had this realization during Eucharist itself. Interesting things happen when we take communion, right? The powerful voice that eventually emerges in the Screwtape Letters and becomes Screwtape reveals that, if nothing else, Screwtape evolved into an unflinching, compelling speaker capable of swaying toward evil even the sturdiest saint. Screwtape, then, is a direct literary descendant of Milton's Satan, not to mention the real-life Hitler. I believe the influence of Milton's Paradise Lost is transparent in Screwtape Letters. For instance, both works were written or conceived during times of war. For Milton, it was during the turmoil of the English Civil War, roughly 1625 to 1650. And this is a time period in which Parliament led a rebellion against Charles I that culminated, unfortunately for Charles, in his execution. I believe that was the only time in English history where the people killed their king. The other kings had been assassinated and so forth. But this is the first time in which the English people actually were involved in the death of their king. So that was happening when Milton was writing Paradise Lost. When Lewis is writing Screwtape Letters, of course, during the early years of World War II. War, by the way, is a key characteristic of the literary epic, the genre of Paradise Lost. And by the way, about the first half of Lewis's A Preface to Paradise Lost deals with the secondary epic or a literary epic. It's only in the second half of the book that he turns to write about certain themes in the work Paradise Lost. So all of the Screwtape Letters are written under the shadow of the European War. In Paradise Lost, Milton explores imaginatively how a war in heaven might have occurred. Indeed, he devotes three books, almost one quarter of Paradise Lost, to Satan's rebellion and the subsequent war in heaven. In Screwtape Letters, Lewis portrays Screwtape and his colleagues engaged in a perpetual dogfight with the enemy, God, and the forces of heaven. In Paradise Lost, Milton shows that the war in heaven was won between not God and Satan, but between Michael and Satan. In fact, in Book 6, Milton underscores this point by showing that God is no more threatened by Satan's rebellion than an elephant is threatened by a gnat. He leaves it to Michael to lead the legions of angels against Satan and the rebel angels. The same point is reinforced in the preface, not to Paradise Lost, but in the preface to the Screwtape Letters, when Lewis writes, "Satan, the leader or the dictator of devils, is the opposite not of God, but of Michael." So while the pervading war metaphor is one transparent link between Paradise Lost and the Screwtape Letters, a second one concerns the nature of Satan and the devils in each work. Two points are noteworthy here. First, Lewis, referencing his friend Charles Williams, and he points out that Satan, in Paradise Lost, is suffering from a sense of injured merit. This is a well-known state of mind, Lewis writes, which we can all study in domestic animals, children, film stars, politicians, fill in the blank there, or minor poets. He, Satan, thought himself impaired because Messiah had been pronounced the head of the angels. In the midst of a world of light and love, of song and feast and dance, Satan can find nothing more to think of more interesting than his own prestige. Through Screwtape, Lewis provides an illustration of Satan's sense of injured merit in letter 19 when he writes this. This is Screwtape writing to Wormwood. "I do not see that it can do any harm to tell you that this problem," and the problem he's addressing is from hell's point of view, the problem of God loving human beings. "I do not see that it can do any harm to tell you that this very problem was a chief cause of our fathers," Satan's, "quarrel with the enemy. When the creation of man was first mooted, and when even at that stage the enemy freely confessed that he foresaw a certain episode about a cross, our father naturally sought an interview and asked for an explanation. The enemy gave no reply except to produce the cock and bull story about disinterested love, which he has been circulating ever since. This our father naturally could not accept. He implored the enemy to lay his cards on the table and gave him every opportunity. He admitted that he felt a real anxiety to know the secret. The enemy, God, replied, 'I wish with all my heart you did.' It was, I imagine, at this stage of the interview that our father's disgust at such unprovoked lack of confidence caused him to remove himself an infinite distance from the presence with a suddenness which has given rise to the ridiculous enemy story that he was forcibly thrown out of heaven." The second point concerns the argument Satan makes in Paradise Lost that he is self-created. In Book 5, Satan is rebuked by leading his rebellion against God by the one faithful angel who was still around, an angel named Abdiel. In part, Abdiel chastises Satan for his lack of gratitude towards the God who had condescended to create him and all other things. Abdiel says, as by this word the mighty Father made all things, even thee, and all the spirits of heaven, by him created in their bright degrees. Satan, however, scorns Abdiel's argument and says, this is one that's worthy of an offended child. He writes, or Milton writes, and has his Satan say, that we were formed then, sayest thou, and the work of secondary hands by task transferred from father to son? This is a strange point and new doctrine which we would know whence learnt. He's thick with irony and sarcasm here. Who saw when this creation was? Rememberest thou thy making while the maker gave thee being? We know no time when we were not as we are now. Know none before us, self-begot, self-raised by our own quickening power. In effect, Milton's Satan makes the nonsense argument that since he cannot remember when God formed him, that is proof that he self-created. Lewis considers this nonsense argument in the preface to Screwtape Letters.
And 3 weeks ago, I started thinking about joy. Joy and temptation. Perelandra is a novel in which the Cambridge philologist named Elwin Ransom, partly because of an odd experience he had had in a previous book where he had been kidnapped and taken to Mars, but partly for the experiences he had there, he finds himself being sent to Venus this time as an emissary of God. When he was on Malacandra, which is the old solar language for Mars, that's the name of it, and that's the language that's used throughout our solar system except on Earth. While he was there, he discovered that every planet has a guardian, an Oyarsa, and a race of beings called Eldella that inhabit deep space. Well, the Oyarsa of Earth had sort of set up shop on his own. Sounds sort of familiar. But Lewis is back, not Lewis, Ransom is back on Earth. Some time has passed, and he calls C.S. Lewis, his friend from Oxford, to meet him at his home and tells him that he's been called to go to Perelandra, which is the old solar name for Venus. He doesn't know why he's going. He doesn't know what he's supposed to do when he gets there, but he knows he's been called to go, so he goes. When he arrives, he finds a world wildly different than our own. He finds a world covered in water with islands of a kind of matted vegetation that float on the surface, and a couple of different pieces of rigid, fixed land, and that's the planet. He finds that there are only two people inhabiting that planet, Tor and Tenadril, the king and queen of Perelandra. Still doesn't know why he's there, but he finds out about them. He eventually discovers that the reason he is there is to prevent the queen from being tempted into sin by another earthling, a physicist by the name of Weston, who has learned how to travel through space. This is one of the two men who kidnapped him originally and took him to Malacandra. But Weston has learned to travel through space, and who is actually coming as a kind of ambassador of Satan. The bulk of the book is a recounting of how he accomplished the task that it's given him, debating, arguing, and finally actually doing physical battle with Weston. There's one passage that occurs shortly after after Ransom arrives on Venus. Before he understands why he's there, he thinks he's alone. He's taken the first few hours to find out how to walk on this strange floating vegetation. He's found some food. He's found that he can drink the water. And all of a sudden, in the distance, several islands off, he sees what looks like a human figure. And he and the human figure start waving to each other, and they get closer and closer. And as they get close enough, he discovers that this figure is a woman. And as they get close enough for her to recognize him, he sees disappointment. She's very excited, and suddenly she looks disappointed. And they fairly quickly lose track of each other. They meet again a little while after that. He begins to talk to her, because remember, he's learned, old Solar, that he thinks, in fact, that that's probably the reason he's being sent. So he begins to talk to her, and he asks her about the disappointment. And he discovers that she doesn't understand what disappointment is. She has no concept of disappointment. She has no concept of anything that we consider normal here. She has spent her entire life, her entire existence has been spent accepting whatever comes her way with joy, not thinking about it, not wondering about it, not thinking about alternatives. She trusts that Maleldil, who is what we would call God the Father, she trusts that Maleldil has sent whatever happens, and that therefore it is the best possible thing for her at the moment. She doesn't question it. Maleldil, in her mind, carries her at every step. Well, now that he's asked about disappointment and made her think about disappointment, he begins to try to explain what it is. And he's limited by the fact that she can only understand the things that are a part of her experience. So he can't describe it in any way other than by using analogy and metaphor. And he says to her, "You could never understand, lady, but in our world, not all events are pleasing or welcome. There may be such a thing that you would cut off both your arms and your legs to prevent it happening. And yet it happens with us." And even now she doesn't really understand. She says, "But how can one wish any of those waves not to reach us, which Maleldil is rolling towards us? How can there be something that happens that you don't want to happen? How could you want to draw back from it?" Well, Ransom has a sense that he shouldn't continue the conversation, but nevertheless, he finds himself beginning to argue with her, trying to explain this idea of wanting one thing and finding another instead. He tells her that when she first saw him, she clearly was hoping to see the king. And he described to her how her appearance changed when she realized that he was not who she thought. And he asked her if that was not an unwelcome event, because it certainly appeared that way to him, and if she had not for even an instant wished him to be the king. Well, at that point, she turned away from him, not in rejection, but in contemplation, in reflection of what he was describing to her. And Ransom suddenly realized that he had done something very dangerous. Her purity and peace, he realized, were not, as he had thought, settled and inevitable. But they were living things and therefore breakable. This was not a perfect paradise established and sinless for eternity. But like paradise in our own world, it was capable of rebellion and failure. It was a balance maintained by mind and therefore capable of being lost. While there was no reason to assume, or no reason even that she should, step out of her innocence, equally there was no reason that she should not take that fatal final step into the psychology of our own race. Like someone on a bicycle riding along a smooth road, it required only a single pebble to change the balance. And Ransom, when he realizes this, is petrified, immobilized by a sense of terror and precariousness. But when the lady turns back to him and he looks at her face, Lewis says Ransom's terror and paralysis changed to a feeling of adventure. And as she spoke the words that she wanted to say to him, she demonstrated that she had indeed lost some of her innocence. She told him that he had forced her to see something that had always been in front of her, but that she had never before seen. She says, this happens every day. Every day I get up, I go to look for food. And when one goes to look for food, perhaps an image of a fruit forms in the mind. Then it may be that one finds a different fruit. And an unexpected joy takes the place of the anticipated joy. She says that what she's never noticed before is that in that instant, there is a kind of pushing back with the mind, a kind of setting aside. The image of the first fruit, the fruit not found, is still there in the mind, and if you wished, you could keep it there, sending your soul after the good you had expected instead of turning to the good you had received. By refusing the real good, you could make the real fruit taste insipid by thinking of the other. And that constituted a choice that she made. She realized that for the first time, Maleldil did not carry her. She walked willingly with him by her choice. And in that recognition lies danger. But in that recognition also lies possibility. It's true that innocence has been lost. As long as Tenedril and the king Tor drifted along, accepting unthinkingly whatever Maleldil sends their way, there was no possibility of disobedience, not even disappointment. But equally, there was no possibility of obedience. Obedience requires choice, and choice requires recognition of options. It is in this recognition that true adventure is born, and why Lewis has Ransom's reaction change from paralyzing terror to adventure as he looks at Tenedril's face. Ransom himself shares that adventure. Almost immediately as the lady finishes their conversation and leaves, Lewis writes that as soon as the lady was out of sight, Ransom's first impulse was to run his hands through his hair, to expel the breath from his lungs in a long whistle, to light a cigarette, to put his hands in his pockets, and in general to do all the things, perform all the rituals of relaxation which a man performs on finding himself alone after a trying interview. But he had no cigarettes, no pockets, nor indeed did he feel himself alone. That sense of being in someone's presence, which had descended on him with such unbearable pressure during the first few moments of his conversation with the lady, did not disappear when he had left her. It was, if anything, increased. Her society had been, in some degree, a protection, and against it, her absence left him not to solitude, but to a more formidable kind of privacy. At first, it was almost intolerable. As he put it to us in telling the story, there seemed no room. But later on, he discovered that it was intolerable only in certain situations, certain moments. At just those moments, in fact, when a man asserts his independence and feels that now at last he's on his own. When you felt like that, then the very air, he said, seemed too crowded to breathe. A complete fullness seemed to be excluding you from a place which nevertheless you were unable to leave. But when you gave into the thing, gave yourself up to it, there was no burden to be borne. It became not a load, but a medium, a sort of splendor as of eatable, drinkable, breathable gold which fed and carried you, not only poured into you, but out from you as well. Taken the wrong way, it suffocated. Taken the right way, it made terrestrial life seem by comparison a vacuum. At first, of course, the wrong moments occurred pretty often, but like a man who has a wound that hurts in certain positions and who gradually learns to avoid those positions, Ransom learned not to make that inner gesture. His day became better and better as the hours passed. So he too experiences what he has shown to Tenedril. And he had good reason to be hopeful that the loss of her innocence was not the initiation of something evil. In the Screwtape letter, Screwtape tells Wormwood that
Lewis is challenging in the personal heresy. But here's the problem. Good writing comes when an author writes about what they know. And there's a subtle difference between writing about what you know and writing about yourself. People who write about themselves have a pretty poor track record of publication. Those books tend to be not very good. And it's hard to think of a book about oneself. Now, somebody who got perilously close to writing about himself was Ernest Hemingway. But he didn't because he really wasn't the heroic figure, though he did hang around the heroic figures. So it's coming close. And in the Screwtape Letters and The Great Divorce, there's a certain transparency in which we recognize people. If you've read Surprised by Joy, then at moments you recognize Mrs. Moore in the Screwtape Letters and in The Great Divorce. And Lewis, when he did decide to write about himself, was straightforward. It wasn't a fiction. He wrote The Pilgrim's Regress, which is his spiritual autobiography, but he did it in allegory and nobody knew what he was talking about. Years later, he wrote Surprised by Joy, which is a straightforward account of himself and his spiritual journey. Then he wrote A Grief Observed. He wrote it anonymously, but it is purely a reflection on his own experience of what it means to grieve. All fair enough. Dimer, I think, is pretty much about himself. But here, he's the tassel-haired poet. And people don't appreciate his poetry. And so perhaps in The Great Divorce, he's getting perilously close to confession. Now, there's a difference between confession and writing about yourself. And so I want to suggest that Lewis is not really violating his principles in terms of criticism, but if you're a Christian, the Lord has pretty much set the parameters around our basic methodology. It is that we shall be witnesses. And so Lewis understood when he was being a witness and when he was writing novels. So in Paralandra, though Dennis kept saying Lewis gets to Paralandra, well, he's not doing that other than slip of the tongue. But the funny thing is that he put himself in Paralandra. Now, I would suggest that that's more a joke than anything else. That he is using an art form that was just beginning to come into its own, science fiction. And science fiction depends upon what John Bunyan called verisimilitude. Verisimilitude. That is, it has the appearance of truth and reality as opposed to fiction. And John Bunyan wrote his Pilgrim's Progress in the verisimilitude of a dream. When Lewis writes The Great Divorce, he does so in the verisimilitude of a dream. And only at the end of the book do you realize he's been dreaming all of this. He is not teaching us about heaven. He's not teaching us about hell. He's not making any theological statements about them in terms of truth statements. It's a pure work of fantasy and fiction, but it is informed by what he knows. And the thing about the journey from hell to heaven is not that it's about the hereafter. He's not writing about the hereafter in the Great Divorce. He's writing about the here and now. He's really writing about those temptations that people cling to and nurture and don't want to give up because they are part of who we are. So in the Screwtape Letters, we have temptation from the perspective of the tempters. In the Great Divorce, we have temptation from the perspective of those who are tempted. And it gets a little bit to the case of Winnie the Pooh. Do y'all all know Winnie the Pooh? Grew up with Winnie the Pooh. And Winnie the Pooh loves stories, but mainly he loves stories about himself. And so in the end, both the Screwtape Letters and the Great Divorce isn't about them. It's about you and you and me and all of us. We've all got our favorite little temptation that we like to nourish and care for and protect because we don't do those bad things. You know, we don't do the things you go to jail for. The Great Divorce is for nice people. And so it's full of jokes. Many of you are of a certain age that you remember a song that came out in our youth, Day Trip Believer. Y'all remember that? Okay. The Day Trip was a popular thing that came into its own during the Depression. And people who did not own great country estates like Hyacinth Bouquet could go down to Victoria Station and get on a coach and take a day trip to the country and sort of look through the windows, visit the great estate, visit Stratford, visit Canterbury, visit the place that they didn't belong to and would never belong to. That's the point of the day trip. This is not your world. It's only for a day. You can go see what it was like. And if anything, you'll go away more envious than when you originally arrived. So that idea of the day trip is something he's playing off that would have been very familiar to his audience in the middle of World War II, because then they're not even getting to take the day trip. And his picture of hell, I think, is fascinating. He doesn't get his picture of hell from Dante's Inferno, though he loved Dante, and they were talking about Dante in the Inklings. Williams was writing on Dante's Inferno, and Dorothy L. Sayers caught the spark and would, in the end, translate all three of the great volumes of Dante's Divine Comedy. But what he chose was what for Lewis would have been a hell, absolute hell on earth, if he had to live in that neighborhood. Here he'd found a place out in the country, and he had trees and flowers. And the other evening when we saw the documentary, the Tolkien children were talking, well, they're older than we are now, but when they were children and would visit the kilns, Lewis had just moved there, and he was talking about all that he was going to do. In his letters to Warney and to other people, he referred to this as the public works. Now, during the Depression, of course, there were all sorts of public works. Here in this country, we're just a couple of miles from the Blue Ridge Parkway, which was one of the great public works in our country. And so the public works at the kilns, he was planting trees. He was planting trees every day. We don't think of him as a gardener, but he was a great gardener. And he was building his own forest. He was cleaning out the old, what would we call it, a bara pit, where they dug out the clay to make the bricks. And that was going to be the pond where he would swim every day. And those of you who've been to the kilns, visit that pond. It needs cleaning out again. It's full of leaves. But when he was there, he had made it into something. Public works. Okay, so here's his idyllic life that he's leading. And oh, how drab and ghastly would it be if he had to live in that part of town. You know, right at dusk. It's not quite evening, but it's not daylight anymore. It's that twilight time where the lights are not quite on and it's just everything's gray and drab. In 1995, I went to Russia to teach at the Baptist school there. And communism had just been gone for a couple of years. And yet there was a lingering to it. That is the climate, the way they had been taught to behave and to act in public. On the subway, everyone sat perfectly still with their face to the ground. And the clothes were brownish, grayish, drabish, no color. And it was no interaction with people. Silent as a tomb in a subway station where there might be 1,000 people. And this is Lewis's picture of hell, a touchstone of what you might experience. And if you are in that sort of dingy place with shops that are not where you really want to buy anything, and you cringe at what it's like, and you want to get away, and this is a place you can't get away. This is where you are, and you grow accustomed to it. Some people grow accustomed to filth. You know, you accept a situation for so long, and that business of silence and not interacting, it's a world of alienation, and you move further away from your neighbors and farther away. And he says, now Napoleon, why, he lives millions of miles away from anybody by now. And so this nether gloom is his picture. But notice what he's doing. He's not giving you a biblical understanding of hell. What he's doing is giving a picture of the kind of world people are tempted to create for themselves right now, in the here and now, before the hereafter. And though there's a long line to get on the bus, in the end, everybody can get on the bus because of the quarreling and the dissension. And
as noted at the start, I'm not sharing the entire talks of any of these three speakers, just enough to give you a taste of what you missed. So be sure to join in next year at the Inklings Fellowship Weekend in Montreat, North Carolina. Don King and Hal Poe, who oversee the event, usually each give a talk, and they usually have two additional speakers as well. As noted at the start, there is a link in the show notes to the main page of their website. Also, if there is time, consider joining them for the Inklings Week in Oxford. That is late July 2016. You can find these show notes either at EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the podcast is most easily found. Again, that's AllAboutJack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. The other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, provides links back to where the audio files are located, but also has other features, which are a variety of articles related to Lewis. That includes a daily fact and quote about him, along with a series examining quotations attributed to Lewis that may not be from him. I hope you like today's show enough to want to share it with others. Also, feel free to leave comments about the program online and consider listening to other shows. At the time this podcast is released, my most recently released new show was my talk about Screwtape's secret weapon, how the devil's attempt to keep things out of our mind. There is a direct link in the show notes to this. That talk was based on expanding one of the appendices in my book that is a companion and study guide to the Screwtape letters. You can learn more about it by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There's a paperback edition available as well as a Kindle edition. The book itself focuses on helping an individual or group dig out for themselves the many fine points Lewis weaved into his insightful work. If you are part of a group that meets regularly or occasionally to discuss Lewis, feel free to contact me to personally give that single talk or to go into all the places in the letter this topic is revealed as part of a 3 or 4 part presentation. Contact me at info@essentialcslewis.com. Again, that's info@essentialcslewis.com for details on how to make those arrangements. Finally, this episode of All About Jack is sponsored by Shelley & Son Books. You can find Shelley & Son Books online at shelleyandsonbooks.com. They specialize in rare books by Lewis, Tolkien, and the Inklings and Friends. You can order by their website, phone, or email. They accept a variety of payments, and you can browse and search their catalog online. Again, find them online at shelleyandsonbooks.com. Thank you.